Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. As we close out 2017, we want to look back now at some of the biggest domestic news stories of the year, with someone who has had a front row seat to many of them. Robert Costa is national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. Robert, welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Great to be with you.
Well, and let's talk about President Trump's first year in office. It obviously dominated the news this year. And I want to start by listening to a little bit of his inaugural address, where he reiterated he was determined to keep his campaign promises.
Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
Robert, how would you characterize President Trump's first year in office?
You have to take a step back and really remember that inaugural address. I was there standing just a few steps as a reporter covering the speech. And he mentioned this idea of American carnage, and Steve Bannon, then the chief strategist, was at his side. And there was an idea in both parties that what we should expect coming from the Trump White House was this populist, nationalist, hardline conservatism that would upend Washington, that would change all the norms in how we operate and how we think about American politics. But yet, as the year ends, President Trump saw that so much of Washington was constrained by the orthodoxies, the rules, the norms that were there before he ever arrived. And he leaves his first year not so much the same kind of hard-charging populist he was at the start, but more of a traditional Republican moving forward on the tax bill, trying to keep his party together in the majorities next year. So what we've really seen is a president who had emerged as an outsider at the beginning, but he hasn't really kept that flame throughout the whole year.
Is that going to hurt him politically, that he's talking there in that address and in other addresses about standing up for the little guy, and then he gets behind a tax bill that the analysts say is going to be much better for the wealthy than the middle class?
President Trump hasn't figured out how to make his populist vision a legislative reality. And it's not entirely his fault. When I'm on Capitol Hill talking to Republican lawmakers, they haven't been able to process, even a year in, what the Trump presidency means for the Republican Party. Ever since Ronald Reagan's presidency, they've been operating in a certain way, hawkish on foreign policy, cutting taxes, shrinking regulations. And when it comes to thinking outside of that box, it's been difficult for them. And President Trump, because he's such a newcomer to Washington, hasn't been able to calculate how he can get the party to come in his direction. So more often than not, he's going in their direction. And that does carry a political cost, because someone who railed against Wall Street in the campaign is now being tagged by Democrats as not so populist as he may have seemed. And you have Democrats who are up for re-election in 2018, such as Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and they think they can reclaim that mantle of populism next year.
Speaking of Wall Street, President Trump couldn't have really asked for a better year on Wall Street than he got in his first year, with the stock market hitting new milestones all the time.
So true. And the challenge for the president will be selling what the White House calls the Trump boom, the markets being high and continuing to grow higher, as part of his political case to the country in 2018 and even in 2020. Democrats really are vexed at times by trying to rail against the tax cuts. But President Trump, in a really old school Republican way, is saying a lower corporate tax rate, tax cuts across the board are going to spur growth. And he's going to take credit, his advisors tell me, for this market surge, and try to say to the country, you may not like my tweets, you may not like my conduct, you may not like me at all, but your 401k package, your investments are up, and maybe you should consider that as well.
What about all the upheaval in the Trump White House that we've seen this year? All of the people who have left and not voluntarily in many cases. Michael Flynn, obviously, who resigned as national security advisor. Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary. Steve Bannon, the White House chief strategist. Sean Spicer. And I could go on. What happened there? Why did so many of the people that President Trump selected turn out to not work out for him?
You have to think about the transition. President Trump's elected, and it's a shock even to people in his inner circle. And they're scrambling in November, December, January to fill the slots in the cabinet. And when it comes to important posts like Secretary of State, they bring in business figures like Rex Tillerson, hoping, as the president confided to some of his confidants, well, he has the look, he has the background, this will probably work. And what they've learned over the course of the year is that some members of the cabinet, like EPA head Scott Pruitt, have been able to develop a relationship, a rapport with the president that makes them politically safe and powerful. Same with CIA Director Mike Pompeo. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions, because he recused himself on the Russia probe. Tom Price, because of the Health and Human Services Secretary who resigned after spending so much time on private planes. They've struggled. So it's been a chaotic moment in the cabinet, a chaotic moment in the White House. And the question moving forward is, can General Kelly, now Chief of Staff, can he continue to be this stable force?
There were some stories that happened, obviously, this year outside of the White House, although sometimes they intersected with what was happening in the White House. I want to listen to a clip here from the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which turned deadly, as we know. Let's listen here. And this may be disturbing to some people. There was a car driving through protesters. As we look back at 2017, how significant was that event in Charlottesville? And what about the White House response to that?
It was a very significant moment in America because at the beginning of the year, we were talking about President Trump as this populist and nationalist figure. But there's a dark underside to that element of America. And that as much as the outsiders are taking control of both parties, Bernie Sanders on the left, Donald Trump on the right, you're seeing the fringe elements of the Republican Party come to the fore and the fringe of just American society in general. And what we saw in Charlottesville was the alt-right, this group that usually stayed submerged in American culture and society, roaring in Charlottesville with their torches lit. A woman dies after one of the alt-right protesters drives his car through the streets. We just heard it. It's a horrible image for the country, horrible memory. But the president believed a few days later that there were both sides responsible for the violence. And he tried to separate those who want to protect memories of the Confederacy from alt-right, racist, white nationalist protesters. And that was a nuance he tried to make, but many people in the country did not appreciate his attempt. And at that Charlottesville moment reminded all of us, too, that race is still at the center of our national discussion.
It seems like there was a period in the fall when every week there was another hurricane that was the biggest hurricane that we've ever seen. Irma, Harvey, Maria. Then we had the wildfires in Utah and California. Not any action, though, on climate change from President Trump. If anything, he's been pulling back the U.S. response to global climate change by pulling out of the Paris Agreement.
And that was as much a statement as his skepticism for climate change as it was about his skepticism for international agreements. And we're really seeing in the Trump presidency a president who's walking away from the world, a president who does not appreciate international agreements, whether it's on climate change or NAFTA or the United Nations or NATO. He really is someone driven by this idea of America first. And climate change is something that this administration is not focusing on at all. In fact, Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, is seen as a foe for many
right.
green interests. And he is one of the most influential members of the cabinet.
We can't get to everything, obviously. There are so many other big stories this year, gun violence, the opioid epidemic. But I do want to get to one more with you that I think has obviously dominated the news recently, and that is all of these allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct, not just in Washington, but in media and in Hollywood, of course, and in other industries. And there's this thing in the background all along, which is, well, what about the allegations against President Trump? What do you make of how this story has evolved over the last month or so?
It has evolved in a different way than you may have predicted a month ago, in the sense that President Trump now is getting more attention for those allegations last year in the 2016 campaign. When those issues came up, Access Hollywood and the many women who stepped forward, more than a dozen with allegations against President Trump, it was in October. It was during the heart of the campaign, the closing days. And it's not that they were ignored, but they didn't dominate in the way you may have thought. And President Trump, of course, won. Now the country's changed, and there's so much more of a climate, thankfully, for women to speak out and for women to be heard. And those women who made those allegations a year ago and felt they maybe weren't heard enough are now being heard again. And that could haunt President Trump as he tries to move forward, in particular because you have major Democrats like Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York becoming advocates for women and major voices on this particular issue. And they're not going to go away in 2018 and 2020.
That's Robert Costa, who is a national political reporter for The Washington Post and the moderator of PBS's Washington Week. Robert, thanks so much once again, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you.
And now for a David and Goliath business story. When you think of English muffins, you probably think of one company, Thomas's, which sells hundreds of millions of English muffins every year. But a startup called Stone & Skillet is trying to change that. 3 years ago, co-owners Dan Carruthers and Kyle Meakin started making English muffins in their apartment. Now they're churning out tens of thousands a week and selling them across the Northeast and perhaps soon across the U.S. Back in May, we took a trip to their Massachusetts bakery. We're in Medford.
Yes.
Outside of Boston.
Yeah.
This looks unassuming. I wouldn't even know this was a bakery.
It is. This used to be a pizza shop, actually, for a long time. Before that, it was a catering shop. When we started off, we weren't making very many English muffins, and we kind of came in here and did what we could with the infrastructure, then made it an open floor plan. So now it's a fully functioning muffin factory, making 40,000 muffins a week by hand right now, out of 750 square feet. So it's come a long way since a pizza shop.
All the Stone & Skillet muffins come from here?
For the most part, almost everything we do is based out of here. And the nice thing about having a pizza shop was that no one's ever made these things this way before, so we kind of created it, so we were able to form it into almost exactly what we needed it to be.
Wow. All right, well, let's take a look inside.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
We walk up the flour-covered steps into the kitchen. There are four or five people working the dough, cooking, and packing muffins, four per bag.
If you just kind of look around, you can kind of stand in the middle of the bakery and just do a 360 and get a sense of how everything's done. Right over here, we're standing next to the mixer, which mixes the dough. And then it goes over to the portioning station, which basically you're just taking the dough, turning it into dough balls. So what we do after they're formed into these 3-ounce dough balls, we put them on sheet trays lined with cornmeal, and we proof them, which means that you're allowing the yeast to kind of rise and do its thing. So after it doubles in size, we bring it over to where this is kind of the secret sauce of the whole operation is, we flat top griddle them instead of ovens. And that's what gives it that kind of nice golden brown top and bottom. It kind of fries up the cornmeal a little bit too, so it adds a nice, texture and aesthetic to the product too.
How long from the moment that you start and put the flour in the mixer to the moment it's ready to be purchased?
Probably about 12 to 15 hours.
Yeah. That's it.
That's it.
Wow.
We kind of keep this whole old New England style theme going. All of our machinery is really basic bakery machinery. Our dough divider was made in East Germany, if that tells you how old it is.
Can I see the dough divider?
Sure.
Yeah. It's pretty cool, actually. So,
R2 dough too.
Yeah.
R2 dough too. It does look like
we were going to color it. We were going to paint it. We were extremely ambitious when we first got it, but the orders start coming in, so we didn't have enough time. But basically, what you do is you take these 7-pound dough heads, is what they're called, and you put them on these plates, and you kind of pat it out into a circle, and then you bring this thing down, it cuts it, and then this plate spins it, and in a minute Jose will show you how it's done. It's pretty cool, actually. But yeah, this is every single muffin is made in this thing.
How did you find that?
We found it on Craigslist, and it's a workhorse. It's been working for us for as long as we've been here.
R2-Dotu.
R2-Dotu.
We've had that thing since we started. Before we started with that, Dan and I, we worked overnight in a couple of our friends' restaurants, and we rolled every single one of them out by hand. So we'd literally be doing thousands of muffins a night, rolling them out, cutting them to the exact weight, putting them on the grill, packaging them by hand, and doing a little twist tie.
Good way to get
out the door. Yeah.
So Jose's patting this out right now, and we'll show you how it goes into the machine here. A little flour on top so it doesn't stick.
R2-Dotu, hard at work. So, how did these guys have success in a business that has had one dominant player for so long? So, one of the things about your muffins is that they are very different from the muffins, the English muffins that we all know and have known forever, the Thomas English muffins. What's different about them?
Well, I think the biggest difference in our muffins compared to a Thomas's is the way that it's made. Again, it's all handmade, and they don't see any ovens. They're flat top griddled, so it gives it a nice golden brown top and bottom.
Tastes kind of like a donut.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a savory donut.
Do you see Thomas as your main competition?
We're kind of in a class of our own. You know, we're something a little bit more premium. You know, there's nothing wrong with Thomas's or any other of those English muffins, but right now we're kind of we're doing our own thing.
Well, you're not known for your nooks and crannies, which they are.
No. Yeah. We don't do nooks and crannies. Yeah.
Why not? We
like a dense product, because what that does is it allows us to apply it to more culinary applications, you know, like burgers, sandwiches, pizzas. It's really good for croutons. You can do a lot of stuff with it. French toast, really good.
Hmm. Why did you decide to get into the English muffin business?
So, I had the idea when I was working for another artisan bakery as a salesman. Dan was a chef in Boston, and we had a lot of mutual chef friends. And every time I went to try to make a bread sale, they would say, "Hey, do you guys have any English muffins?" And I'd go back to my boss, and he'd say, "Oh, we don't make them. That's not really baking. It's kind of this in-between cooking and baking." I came to Dan, and I said, "We have our chef friends. They're curing their own back bacon. They're poaching their eggs in champagne vinegar, and they're putting it on Thomas's English muffin. And it's not necessarily the right application for them. So let's create the best English muffin in the world and see what happens."
I know that one of the big moments for you was when Whole Foods decided to carry your muffins. How did you get that to happen?
So we were at the Boston Food Festival, and we brought what we thought was enough product for the whole 5-6 hour event. And we ultimately ended up running out in an hour. But while we were there, somebody came up to me and said, "Are you guys in Whole Foods?" And I said, "No, you know, we've always thought we should be, but we're not." And he said, "That's because you haven't met me yet." And he ended up being one of the local foragers. And within a few months, we were in every Whole Foods in New England and kind of took off from there.
And now expanding.
Yeah, we've expanded out to the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut Whole Foods. And we're in discussions with the Mid-Atlantic region and the Rocky Mountain region as well.
Now, no offense to this space, but you're not going to be able to stay in here much longer,
no,
are you?
No way. No. It's the walls are closing in. And we're actively looking for much larger spaces in and around Boston. We want to stay in Boston because it's our hometown, and we kind of claim that old New England style, so it's part of the brand. But we're actively looking for more automation, something that keeps the integrity of the product, but also is able to supply the demand that we're starting to recognize nationally.
I know you've been looking at a very expensive machine.
Yeah, they're really expensive. Bakery production machines are extremely expensive, but this one in Germany particularly took us about 3 years to find this, and it pumps out 4,500 muffins an hour. And currently we're doing 400, maybe 500 on a good day.
Yeah. I mean, if you were going to tell me that the biggest purchase I'd ever make in my life was a machine that would make English muffins, I wouldn't have believed you. But it's more than the majority of people's homes cost. So we're working our way towards it.
How many people do you employ right now?
We employ about 25 to 30, all said and done.
And do you think that as you expand, you're going to employ more people?
Absolutely. It's such a labor-intensive process. We have to find people who care just like we do, and we've been lucky to do that. But since we make these things by hand, it's a human process. And even when we bring in other machinery, it's going to continue to be, because we want to monitor that quality.
What's the biggest failure that you've experienced along the way?
Wow. How much time do you have? We grew too rapidly. We brought on people on our team really quickly. We ramped up for projected sales that didn't hit as quickly as we thought they would. And then we backed off and the sales hit, right? So it's just this, when you're growing, you're always trying to find the right ratio of growth to kind of profit.
Well, so many businesses like yours don't end up making it. They fail at some point. Are you still worried about that, or you think you've gotten over that hurdle?
Well, I mean, they say it's the first 18 months, and then, you know, you're in the clear. But I can tell you that that is not the case. You're always you're always at risk.
So do you think in 5 years, if we were to talk to you, you'll be bigger than Thomas?
We hope so.
He's got a 100-year head start, so... the goal is to ultimately grow this into what we know what we can be.
That's Kyle Meekins and Dan Carruthers, co-owners of Stone and Skillet. We visited their bakery in May. And since then, the English Muffin Company has expanded and moved its bakery from Medford, Massachusetts to Boston. They invited us back to see the difference.
This is it. I mean, this is, it's, you know, it's probably, man, five times bigger than Medford. Just being in this location, there's inherent efficiencies. Like, there's loading docks. There's hood space that we didn't have originally. And right now we're doing about 60,000 to 70,000 a week, but we can go way higher than that. So we're ramping up sales quite a bit.
We did get a little bad news. That machine you hear is the new bigger and faster R2 Dough 2. The little dough separator now sits in the corner of the new bakery, retired.
We can't let him go. I mean, he's part of the family. I think at some point we're going to bronze him and make him into a fountain at the Stone and Skillet headquarters when we get big enough. But yeah, no, he's not going anywhere.
On this day after Christmas, many Americans are heading to the mall to return what they got for Christmas and maybe buy something even more expensive. It's a big day for retailers, and according to MasterCard Spending Pulse, retail sales in the U.S. have already risen at their best rate since 2011 this season. Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And there's a little bit of nuance here because we've been talking for months about what a difficult time retailers have been having, but it sounds like overall it's been a good season for them?
It has been a good season. The biggest winners are online, because every year we shift more of our buying from brick and mortar to online, but both are up. Retail is up 11% compared to 5.4% in-store sales. That's compared to last year. So we're actually doing well. We've not only moved over some of the shopping to online, but even bricks and mortar retailers are doing particularly well.
How do you explain that?
Well, look, unemployment is down. People are feeling relatively positive about the economy. The stock market, which doesn't affect everybody, but it does express some of the sentiment that's out there, is doing well. We're seeing the places that are doing well, the places that cater to working Americans. Shares of Macy's and The Gap are way up as a result of this. So I would say this, Jeremy, it's good. It's better than expected. It doesn't get us out of the larger problem we've got with retailing.
And of course, none of this even includes what's going on today, which is a huge day for sales around the country.
So today's an interesting day. It's Boxing Day. You know, I'm Canadian. So in Canada, we celebrate Boxing Day. We don't have a Black Friday. These days we do, because the American retailers have brought it to Canada. But Boxing Day was the big day for sales. Now, in America, most people who return things do it today or tomorrow, the 26th or the 27th. So what stores have done is they've decided, let's inherit this Boxing Day thing, deep discounts, deep sales. So the idea is, if Americans are going back into stores with the goods that they got for Christmas on the 26th and 27th, let's have them buy things with deep sales. So today is a big return day and a big shopping day, and I think we're morphing from returns into yet another sort of a Black Friday Junior.
I already bought something today. So, and it was on sale, like really, on sale. You mentioned the stock market. As we close out this year, we're looking at a market that has grown almost 300% since March of 2009 when it hit the bottom. We're in the middle of the second best rally since World War II.
Yep.
Can this continue?
My short answer is one shouldn't plan for it to continue. The S&P 500, which is the way I like to measure things, is up 18% this year. Now, it's been up more. George H.W. Bush's first year was bigger, and President Obama's first year was much bigger, but that's because March of 2009 is when we hit a market bottom. That was President Obama's first year, so it was up more than 30%. I would say this. This is a market that has not seen a correction in a long time. There are real reasons, because of the tax cuts and because of business sentiment, that businesses could do very well in 2018. I would say if you're the average investor and you're saving for retirement, try and get into your account, know what your password is, and think about rebalancing. I hope this continues to go up, but you should be prepared for it not to.
It's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks so much and happy New Year to you.
And to you, sir.
Application deadlines are coming up for high school seniors interested in going to college next year. It is a stressful time. Youth Radio talked to three seniors about their mad dash to the finish line.
The application process has been pretty stressful so far and has definitely created a lot of points of contention around my family as well.
Procrastination was definitely an issue for me because now it's due in like a week and I'm definitely not even close to being done.
So for me, I'm having to juggle the writing, but there's also getting letters of rec, applying for financial aid. There's just a ton of stuff, and I keep worrying that I'm going to miss something.
And it's just, like, really stressful with the essays, like, because you have to write about yourself, and I find that it's really hard sometimes. It's just, like, when I have to do it to apply to college, it's like I suddenly, like, go blank, and I'm like, I don't know who I am.
I feel like teachers have not been the kindest in terms of assigning us less work. It's almost like I'm doing double the amount of work that I would do in any other year. And there's actually like a lot of consequences. So you have to be really, really careful.
I've got a handy dandy Google spreadsheet. I have all the schools that I'm applying to, then all their separate components. So I have the main Common App essay, then I've got each school's supplemental essays, my scores, financial aid, have I selected my major, and I have all the things I haven't done in red. And then once I've done it, I go through and put it in green. And needless to say, it's mostly red.
I would get frustrated at my parents for trying to push me too much or like trying to micromanage the things that I was doing, not really realizing that they just want the best for me.
My parents definitely have a facade of calmness and acceptance. They're always like, Sierra, we'll love you no matter where you get in. We want to sponsor your dream. But I know, they don't fool me. They have expectations.
That was Sierra Fung Horvath, Arnav Gupta, and Nina Roll. Their story was produced by Youth Radio. And joining us now to talk more about what high school seniors should be doing this holiday break is Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, my alma mater. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
And there are some high school seniors who may have already heard from their first choice college, but for the rest, I guess this is crunch time.
Yes. This is the time where I sometimes feel sad that they don't have a winter break, but we're here to help them.
They should have a winter break. They're given
break. Yes, they need a winter break.
But they just can't use it. So what do students need to be doing at this time of year?
Sure. Depending on if they did do early action or early decision pools, first of all, based on outcomes from that GRE, they really have to process those. Some may get denied. Some may get deferred to the next round or get accepted. But the reality is a majority of students have colleges that are basically what's called the regular pool, and they have deadlines of January 1 to 15. So they have a lot of tasks that they can do to help organize themselves and to basically try to manage this in a way where they can stay sane and still have time for fun and for holidays.
And you've got a list of tips for students who are in this process right now. The first one, aim for authenticity on your college application. What do you mean by that?
Yes. Too many times I think students forget to think about the process that is about them knowing who they are and thinking about building a list of schools where they will grow and thrive and create the authentic version of themselves when they actually go to college. So we try to help students keep this process in mind and just say, look, the reality is you follow your moral compass, you build a college list, and you talk about things that you're doing that are authentic to you and not just activities, let's say, that you're doing because you think an external reader wants to see those from you. Too many times our kids have pressure on doing things for an external reader, and they have to just be themselves.
You also say that they should vet their list of colleges that they want to apply to one last time.
Yeah. Jeremy, the reality is there are students that apply to two or three colleges. There are students that will apply to 37 colleges.
37 colleges?
Yes. Wow. And the reality is oftentimes at this time of year, we have to say to them, please, if you did get into some early schools, let me use my high school, for example. We've got the University of Illinois in our backyard. We had about 57 seniors apply. So if they were accepted now before winter break, now's their time to relook at their list and to basically think, okay, are any of these schools on my list honestly schools that I would go to over the University of Illinois? So you take what's already in your back pocket. I've got these awesome opportunities. And now you compare what you think you're applying to later and say, what are the realities of me going to that school if I get in? And too many times students, if they're honest with themselves, will say, yes, I need to cut out three or four schools because I will not attend there if I'm accepted. Or they really realize, Jeremy, they don't know why they're applying.
How many schools should they be applying to?
The average is still 6 to 8 schools. Our recommendation, school counselors across the country will always advocate for staying under double digits. Now, the common application allows up to 20 schools. But I do think the reality is now 10 and under is still the advisable amount because you're going to be a better applicant when you can focus and write about the school in an authentic way that fits you versus that mentality of I'm just going to keep throwing darts and applying and hoping something sticks and they don't really know why that university fits them.
Okay, back to that winter break that these students are not going to be getting. You say that they should make lists and plot out their winter break hour by hour.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want the seniors listening to kill me, okay, but I do believe, and I do this for myself, it's easy to say, I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time. But if you really think about it, and I was giving an example to my seniors, if you literally get up at 9 in the morning and you go to bed at 11 p.m., you've got a good amount of time for you to map out, what am I going to work on? How am I going to spend time with friends and family? Maybe watch my favorite television show or listen to a podcast. This isn't about work, work, work. This is about balance. So I think if we can help students realize if there's 14 hours in the day that you're up and active, how do you plot that out so that you're focusing on college essay writing? Did you make sure that your test scores were released? Have you confirmed on all of your portals that your teacher recommendations are there? I mean, even have you taken time to write a thank you note to someone who has supported you through this process? If they really map out hour by hour, there is time to get this done and for them to also have a holiday break.
I just can't get over the idea of waking up at 9 a.m. Those are the days. That must be nice.
Okay. Yeah, I thought I'd let them sleep in a little bit.
Okay. Well, one of the things that you say that they ought to do in one of those hours of the day is make sure that they proofread what they're sending out.
Obviously, you don't want to send off your application to Michigan saying, and for all of these reasons, I can't wait to attend Northwestern, right? So Right. Obviously, proofreading and making sure that you're not getting to the point where you're trying to recycle essays and you're accidentally leaving in names of schools for other institutions, that's a huge no-no. But in reality, this is also not only a personal statement for them to learn about your uniqueness and how you fit the school, but it is serving as a writing sample for the college to see how you use words, how you critically think. So it's important for them to write those essays. And they do need to have someone on their support team to help them. But I also caution them on not having too many. If 6 or 7 people start giving them feedback, and oftentimes the feedback is not consistent because everyone reads differently, they start losing their voice. And we want the seniors to feel comfortable when they hit submit that that's their application and it wasn't over-edited.
And you say they should submit early and then drop the mic.
You know, I want them to be empowered here, Jeremy. I think we have high-achieving kids. We have students all across the nation that are doing this process if they have aspirations of going to a 4-year school. And the reality is a lot of our students can tend to be perfectionistic or they can tend to procrastinate, right? So we know that in the reality, while there's a window of time for them to submit an application, I don't want them submitting on the due date. I'm not naive. I know they do it. I've had college admissions officers write me back and say, yes, we can see the date stamp time, and kids are submitting at 11:58 when the deadline was 11:59 p.m. that night. So we do know that that happens. But the reality is late applications are risky because servers crash, and you could actually just be sitting there and have things lost because you waited until the last hour. So seniors, if you're listening, if you're going to wait till the due date, do not go past 5 p.m. I would highly advocate that you submit 24 to 48 hours before a deadline. That is my hope for them.
I seem to remember trying to catch one of these deadlines when I was applying for schools and thinking that I could fax the application to the West Coast and have somebody send it before 5 p.m. in California because then I'd buy myself another 3 hours.
Okay, we're not going to talk about strategizing, are we?
No, I guess not. That's Lisa Maselli, who is Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, my high school, and we will have a list of all her tips at hereandnow.org. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
You too. China is the world's biggest market for robotics. Last year, the country installed nearly as many robots as the U.S. and Europe combined. It's all part of a government mandate we told you about yesterday, backed by billions of dollars to build as many robots as possible. Now, Asma Khalid from member station WBUR brings us part two of the story, how American robotics companies are trying to be a big part of that march to automation.
Rodney Brooks is a robot guy with white wavy hair and an Australian accent that's hard to miss. He has spent his entire life working on robots and artificial intelligence.
I was a co-founder of iRobot, which makes the Roomba vacuum cleaner and makes them in China. By around 2004, I noticed that labor wasn't as plentiful as it had been in China.
Brooks says China's one-child policy had devastated the country's labor pool. 90 million workers will be gone by 2040. That's according to data from the World Bank.
Everyone thinks China has an infinite supply of labor, but it doesn't.
Brooks realized cheap labor in China wasn't going to be around forever.
So there's going to be some disruption worldwide in manufacturing, which is one of the reasons I started this company.
The company he's referring to is his latest venture, Rethink Robotics. It makes intelligent robots that can be used for simple, repetitive manufacturing tasks. Brooks says his first robot was designed for the U.S. market, but then he created a smaller robot called Sawyer. It's a red arm with grippers, and he took Sawyer to China.
We saw that there was a labor shortage in China, and electronics manufacturing was not going to move away from China, no matter what anyone says. So we went to where the market is.
I'm in a massive convention center in South Beijing for the World Robot Conference, and there are thousands of people here. Everywhere you turn, there are companies demoing their latest product. You can see industrial arms or little dancing humanoid robots performing a routine, or even a life-size robotic version of the former Chinese basketball star Yao Ming shooting a ball through a hoop. It's here at this expo that I also spot a booth with robots from Boston-based Rethink Robotics. That's Sawyer, the Rethink robot, putting together electronic equipment. And every few minutes, a commercial blares out from the sound speakers, advertising the robot's flexibility and safety. On the other side of this booth, there's a robot making coffee, and that's where we meet Tina Tang with one of Rethink's China distributors. Tang says Rethink is targeting the 3C market. That's short for computer, communication, and consumer electronics.
We started to officially sell the robots in June of last year. Since then, we've sold around 400 machines.
Tang says Rethink has sold robots to Foxconn, Amazon, BYD, the car manufacturer, and Weishan, the biggest gas and electric meter company in China. She says each Rethink robot arm costs about $45,000.
The price tag is a challenge because there are more and more local robotic companies emerging and they offer a better price.
This point on price is something we heard from both a Chinese researcher and a consumer electronics CEO. The other criticism we heard is that although the Rethink robots are really high-tech, and in fact superior to what else is out there, they're not necessarily practical for a Chinese factory. But there is still a massive appetite for robots among Chinese manufacturers. The thing is, there are also now massive Chinese government subsidies for domestic robotic companies. Beijing is pouring tens of billions of dollars into robotics and AI. President Xi Jinping has an ambitious plan called Made in China 2025. The goal is to turn his country into a hub for advanced manufacturing through automation. Tang says this policy is great, and it'll help shine a spotlight on robotics.
But comparatively speaking, because Rethink is a foreign brand, it won't get the same strong support from the government as the local brands.
Still, U.S. companies want into the Chinese market, and the Chinese want them to come. Back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on the second floor of an old stone building, there's a venture capital firm called InTeahouse. Now, there's a lot of VC firms around this town, but this one is unusual.
We build a connection with local entrepreneurs and international investors.
That's Xin Lu. She runs InTeahouse. She grew up in Beijing, and her mission with this firm is to build a global network that revolves around China.
If you need to raise money, if you need to fund the market, if you need to fund the partner in China factory, we help you.
This fall, for the second year in a row, InTeahouse took about a dozen Massachusetts robotics companies on a tour through China to meet investors, customers, and business partners. So while selling automation in America isn't always easy, in China, finding eager customers is no problem. For Here and Now, I'm Asma Khalid.
And Asma's story was made possible by the Bringing Home the World International Reporting Fellowship Program for Minority Journalists at the International Center for Journalists. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.